Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Triangulation, episode 115, recorded August 14th, 2013. Esther Dyson. It's time for Triangulation, the wonderful show that every week brings in some of the most interesting people, the smartest people, people who are making a difference in the world, and we get to talk to them, and that's what I love, just spending some time chatting with fascinating people. What could be a better show, right? I'm really thrilled about our guest this week. She has done so much, and in so many different areas, it's going to be hard to just pick one or two. Esther Dyson started as a journalist, came from a pretty good pedigree. Her father, Freeman Dyson, was a very famous.
Still is.
I know. 89. Wow.
He's having his 90th birthday next month, and I'm using up many of my airline miles flying in all the family members.
Oh, that's so cool. Your mother was a mathematician. Your brother is a historian of digital technology, George. I didn't know this. Your grandfather was Sir George Dyson was a composer.
That's right.
So, wow. That's why we were talking when you joined us. I was talking about IQ and stuff. And that's why I was fascinated, because there are some families, and you see this every once in a while, where just everybody is excelling in the family. And it's really a remarkable thing to see. And it's rare.
Yeah.
I know. You're not going to let me tell you how great you are. But it's great to have Esther Dyson on.
Yeah. Interview Esther. Tell her.
Oh, yeah. No kidding. Yeah. So let me ask you. You were aware growing up, I'm sure, that your father was a well-known physicist. Was it an unusual childhood because of that?
No. I mean, first of all, when I was young, he wasn't that well-known. I mean, comparatively, but we didn't go around thinking, oh, gee, we've got a famous dad.
Right.
And he certainly didn't make us talk about physics at the dinner table. He was, you know, maybe partly because of his dad, he was very concerned with us having a completely normal childhood. So, I mean, maybe it wasn't normal, but we felt it was.
Right.
And he came home for dinner pretty much every night. He worked at the Institute, which was 2 miles away, and in the winter, he would steal our sled to go to work in the morning because it was downhill. And if we wanted the sled, we had to go pick it up from his office.
Did he ever bring Albert Einstein home for dinner?
I must have met him once or twice, but I was 4 when he died.
Right,
so
right.
Once Bill Gates asked him this question, which was one of these wonderful self-referential things, and he said, well, you know, you didn't exactly go up to him and say, hey, Al, how's tricks? So.
Also at Princeton at that time, also at the Institute. So, you know, there's so many things we could talk about. And maybe I'll go backwards because you have a lot of investments. You're on the board of a lot of companies. Two things that really interest me that are your current interests. One is commercial space. It says you've been waitlist 5 or 6 times on your bio.
Yeah. it's really fun. That's why I want to go to space. I want it to be waitlist long enough for it to be boring.
Oh, wouldn't that be cool?
Yeah.
So you're not one of those people that gets space sick?
Sometimes I get queasy. Everybody does. And that's another reason to go for 2 weeks, because after 2 or 3 days,
you get used to it.
Unless you really have a problem, you don't.
And then the other thing that I love is the Personal Genome Project. And well, I've applied. I would gladly do this, but only a handful of people, 10 people, I think, have done it so far. This is the project, and we've interviewed George Church, to map your entire genome. But the position of the Personal Genome Project is, well, you know, we're doing this for science. We're doing this so people can ask for your genome and do research on the entire medical history along with the entire genome, and you can see if there's correlations. But the only way this is going to work, we can't keep you anonymous. So you got to say it's public. That's pretty brave.
And guess which is harder to get, your genome or your medical records?
Right. I don't know.
It's harder to get your medical records, because I got my genome just by giving a little sample.
Right.
And my medical records, I hired a summer intern, and she still didn't manage to, get most of them.
Well, because of all the legal constraints around it with HIPAA and everything, I guess that kind of makes sense.
The legal constraints are often just an excuse for being too busy or can't find them. Actually, if we're going to spend our time doing paperwork, we're going to do it billing patients, not finding records for you.
Wow. You know, one of the things, you know, I did apply for, but one of the things I had to think about was, in some ways, revealing your personal genome is revealing your kid's genome.
It's revealing some of it, but honestly, I'd much rather reveal my genome than my behavior. I mean, your genome is just what you got.
Right.
Your behavior, you're responsible for better or worse. And so I think people vastly, your genome does identify you uniquely, unless you're an identical twin. It does indicate some diseases or conditions you might be susceptible to, and it might give some indication of potential intelligence. But the sort of the moral, the thing you're responsible for, the thing that makes you interesting is not your genome, it's what you did with it and your behavior.
Good point. And 23andMe, you're on the board there too, and I've also done the cheek swab on that.
You have to spit.
Spit, that's right, into a little vial.
The other guys do the cheek swab.
Right. I always blank out the spit part.
Yeah.
it's a not inconsiderable amount of spitting involved. It took me a little while to gather all the saliva needed.
Yeah, but it's very tidy.
That's less informative, though. What you did at PG, the Personal Genome Project, is a much bigger thing, right?
Well, yes and no. I mean, the thing about 23andMe is it makes the information accessible and understandable and even to some extent actionable. PGP gives you... So I like to say the genome, it's kind of like a Russian novel, assuming you don't speak Russian. And the PGP gets you the entire Russian novel.
Right.
But 23andMe gets your Russian essay, but a glossary as well. And so it actually makes the meaning of it, to the extent we know it, much more accessible to somebody.
It's kind of fascinating. For instance, I have 2.6% Neanderthal in me.
Yeah, so do a lot of people.
That's pretty common. Yeah. The health overview is interesting, the recommendations.
Yes.
But this is a first step, isn't it? I mean, this is a very almost primitive compared to what we'd like to do with this.
Okay, so I mean, if you want something interesting and edgy or whatever, I have double the average chance of getting Alzheimer's.
Wow.
But that's 14% versus 7%,
right.
And they both round to 10%. So the point is sort of, it's really interesting to know that, but
it's not really actionable.
No, and nor does it make me. It's not changed my life. There's some things that might, and certainly if you find out you're celiac, you can proactively change your life and not eat gluten and feel much better.
Right.
But, it's to some extent, people right now overrate the knowing part.
Right.
Long run is going to be really, really interesting. The reason I'm holding my hand up for your viewers is because of this sound thing.
It's good, though. You're doing a great job. I thank you for doing that.
Yeah.
It sounds great.
Long run, we hope to have many, many more genomes, and then they'll be much more interesting because we can compare genomes to phenotypes of millions of people and get sort of a better understanding of what they mean, and second, how these things work. I mean, now we understand associations and correlations, but we still don't understand the dynamics of a lot of these diseases.
Right. The other thing I liked and I had fun with on 23andMe is finding second and third and fourth cousins. I haven't found any close family members that I didn't know about, but...
I found a guy, John Wilbanks, whom you could also interview. He's head, I think, of something like the Open Data Alliance, but he's actually well-known in the genetics field and a big believer in open data, is actually a third cousin or something like
that's
that.
Neat.
Yeah.
Isn't that fun? I mean, I think it's exciting. I hope that we make progress in it. And certainly I volunteered. I said, George, if you want me, You got me. Anything you need, I'll give you my. You're right. Medical records, that might be a little bit tough, but I'll give you all the gene material you can use.
Yeah, I hate to tell you, without your medical records, your genome isn't worth that
it's not,
much.
Right. It's all about matching. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I also, oh gosh, there's so much to talk about. Let's talk more about the space flight, and then I want to get to ICANN because you were one of the founding.
Yes.
Yeah, and certainly we're thinking a lot about internet governance and who should be in charge and so forth. But let's talk about commercial space flight, another big interest of yours. We're making great progress there too. That's exciting.
We are. Yeah. We're getting to the point where it's really a market. It's not just a collection of sort of billionaire projects. There's actually companies competing. There's investors coming in. There's real competition, market positioning. I'm working on a chart that shows all these companies in relation to one another. Not a quadrant chart, but more a timeline. And timeline is the horizontal axis and where you're going, whether it's suborbital, orbital, asteroids, moon, Mars, whatever, is the vertical axis. And you can actually fill out that chart quite nicely.
What do you think would be the most profitable, not profitable, but fruitful direction to take a commercial space flight into? Would it be asteroid harvesting, a trip to Mars?
You should do all of them. And that's what's exciting. Yeah, it's not a single project. It's not just one government doing it. It's a lot of different companies focused on everything from asteroid mining to getting people to the moon to figuring out how to fly around Mars or actually land on Mars. And they're all valid. Like, you know, some people, Christopher Columbus went to the Americas, though he was trying to reach India. Other people did go to India. And same thing.
Do you feel that we live in unusually interesting times, or is it just human experience?
They're unusually interesting, and more than that, an individual can know more of those things. I mean, Christopher Columbus's time was definitely interesting, but there just weren't that many people who really
right.
had any understanding of what was going on. Now, I mean, I live a very privileged life, but I know what's going on in Russia. I know what's going on in commercial space. I know what's going on in genetics. I get to meet all these interesting people. It's an amazing time to be alive, and I think you get some of the same thing if you're talking to George Church 1 week and
yeah.
Astor Teller the next.
Yeah, we talked to Planetary Resources just a few weeks ago about the ARCID project. And of course, they raised their money. They're launching their little thing, but they're also going right. on to explore and one day hope to harvest asteroids. I feel like I do feel like the last century was an amazing century of growth. Starting with the airplane and commercial flight and getting up to the information revolution, that this century might even be faster, more exciting, even more things will happen. And yeah, we got a ringside seat. So I feel happy to be living in this time.
Yeah, but it's complicated. And so we now have, in addition to all this stuff, we have nuclear bombs. We yeah. have so much food that people are getting sick from too much food rather than too little food. So in a sense, our natures are catching up with us. I mean, in the past, people tried to kill each other, but they weren't that successful at it. Now
we're too good at it.
Yeah, you can really take out a lot of people.
Yeah. Or use drones and anonymously take out people. You're also part of the Sunlight Foundation, which I think is a great organization trying to make government transparent and accountable. There couldn't be a better time to work on that than right now. What do you see as the challenges? Not just government, but in general. I mean, I'm sure you're following closely, as we all are, the PRISM story, the Edward Snowden story, and the NSA. And
yeah.
What would you say about all of this?
At least give us transparency back. It's sort of what David Brin said long ago. If they're going to watch us, at least we need the right to watch them and hold them accountable. And for all the depressing news we're getting about the United States, believe me, it's less visible and less remarked upon, but more prevalent
right.
in many countries outside the U.S.
Right.
You know, at least here we can object and complain and file lawsuits. And, you know, it's disturbing that we don't win the lawsuits, but at least we're filing them.
And we can have the conversation without fear of being dragged off, at least so far.
By and large. I mean, you know, Edward Snowden will say, well, they dragged me off. But
yeah.
it's basically, you know, I don't want to be an apologist, but you haven't seen censorship till you've been to other countries.
Well, and you've been you were very involved in that, weren't you, with the post-Soviet Eastern Europe transition?
Well, I spend a lot of time in Russia still.
Yeah.
But honestly, it's complicated. There's self-censorship. There's government ownership of the media. There's, I mean, now David Cameron is trying to, quote, censor pornography in the United Kingdom, which is nutty. Once you start censoring pornography, then you use it to censor everything else that's, quote, inconvenient for the government.
Yeah, yeah. Great. but you're an optimist.
Yes.
How do you maintain your sunny disposition in the light of all this?
Well, so I like to say I'm an American. When I see a problem, I see an opportunity to fix something.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of ingenuity devoted to fixing things. There's a lot of ingenuity devoted to still to investigative journalism. God bless Jeff Bezos for buying the Washington Post, and I hope leaving it alone.
What do you know about that? Have you talked to Jeff about it? What is he up to?
I haven't talked to him, but he's on the board of the Long Now Foundation, which believes in thinking long term. He's not on the board. He's a donor to it.
You're on the board of that, aren't you, though?
I am indeed. Yeah. So I'm aware of his good works. He also owns a rocket company.
True.
He does those things privately. Then there's Amazon, which he runs very well, but also for the long term. So my assumption is that he's investing in the Post for the long term and not to make money, but to basically to support journalism and the survival of civil society long term.
Yeah, I don't know him, but that was my take also, that it was almost an Andrew Carnegie kind of philanthropic thing.
Except Andrew Carnegie waited till way late in his life.
He was trying to repair a very bad reputation by giving a bunch of libraries.
Yeah.
it's very different. I think Jeff's reputation's pretty unsullied. He's never busted a well, maybe he has. I don't know. Maybe busted a few
years. I mean, there are people who think his tax stuff is a little disingenuous. But no, he's not a robber baron.
No, by no means.
I mean, I think he's got a good reputation and is trying to enhance it rather than trying to whitewash it.
We are. And that's another thing that's interesting about this era. And I know you're very close to Bill Gates or were. And there are some of the richest people ever in history have been created, new wealth from this revolution, who are very different from the robber barons of the 1900s. I mean, Mr. Gates is donating the vast majority of his wealth to very good causes.
Yeah, they're starting early, which is nice.
That's
they're
great.
Starting when they still can, you know, when they still have not just money, but actual energy to do interesting things. Zuckerberg in Newark is another one, which I like.
Big Cory Booker supporter. He must be very happy today.
Yeah.
Yeah, Cory won his primary with help from Mark Zuckerberg. Yeah, this is neat. I think this is. Do you think there's more of a conscience among capitalists now than there was in that or those earlier times?
I don't know. I mean, there certainly were lots of. You know, society as a whole has become more trashy.
Is that true?
There certainly were a lot of philanthropists in the past, and there was, I would say, probably more charity. A charity of mind as well as money, especially when you couldn't count on the government to do things.
Right.
I mean, there were poor houses and orphanages and, you know, but certainly thinking of, I mean, to me, what really excites me is more businesses that do good and do well and therefore are sustainable by doing good. So I've now got three investments in Africa, which are all for profit, but I would call them social development in some way. I'm starting something called Hiccup, which is trying to prove that you can invest in healthy living in small communities to start, and that you actually will get a return on that investment. And if I prove that, then more people will do it, and maybe they'll do it in large communities as well.
We should we should mention that we're talking to Esther Dyson, a legend in the technology industry, and a real creator in so many ways, starting with her Release 1.0 newsletter and conferences, the Adventure Holdings.
PC Forum it was called.
PC Forum, that was the name I was trying to remember. Yes. That was right. That was the first, before long before Demo and these others. That was the one. And you're at Meetup right now. We should thank them for letting us call you at Meetup, meetup.com, one of your investments.
In the slightly dark room.
You're in the mother's Meetup room.
Yes, right.
There's the kids, and that's so cute. I love it. I love it. Let's talk a little bit about the internet. How important is you were founding chairman of ICANN, the Internet Corporation for Sign, Names, and Numbers, a successor to IANA. And the kind of extra, it was, I think it was the Commerce Department, but it was kind of extra governmental governance.
Yeah, it had this immaculate conception myth that the people of the internet came together and
if only
created it. Yeah, it was basically kind of the U.S. Commerce Department and the European Union with a little bit of Japan thrown in. And our magazine, who's now back in the news as being involved with the Clinton Foundation, was probably the actual grandfather of the thing. It was supposed to be run by John Postel, who had run IANA, which was... Right. But he unfortunately died of a heart attack. Well, he died of complications from surgery about a month after ICANN was formed, so that the actual running of it was done by a corporate litigator, which was somewhat unfortunate. Oh. Yeah.
Postel, and this shows you where the internet, how what a homespun enterprise the internet was in the earliest days. It seemed like it was Postel by himself that was basically doing it.
It was. And one day he just sort of in a fit of pique redirected, I don't know, half the internet or something. And that was when the government said, oops, we'd better put something more institutional in place here. So the commercial types thought it was a government plot to control the internet. The foreigners thought it was a U.S. plot to control the internet. The internet community, it was all, there was a lot of controversy and commotion. And the biggest thing, our biggest task was to break NSI's monopoly. NSI became VeriSign.
They were running all the root servers in those days.
Yes, and all the registries. And so we did break up that monopoly, but it kind of, we were, rather than being immaculately conceived, we were actually conceived in a war. And we used up a lot of our resources breaking down the monopoly. And then we didn't have enough left, I think, to properly regulate the thing, nor did we get enough outside. We weren't really accountable to the public. We were accountable to the registries and registrars that ICANN delegated the business to. So it was not well designed in terms of being publicly accountable. And then we're accountable to a bunch of governments. And just think back in this interview to what I said about governments and censorship. You know, they're not necessarily the right people to be doing this either.
In fact, hasn't it been the Russians who have been pushing hard to change the way the whole thing's governed?
It's not just the Russians. There's a bunch of them.
Among others, yeah.
Among others, yeah.
Yeah. But all of this stuff that we're talking about, the internet plays a huge component in it. I mean, it could easily be said to be the engine of change, at least the highway. If the engine is the digital technology, then the highway is the internet, and that has been vital to all of the things we've talked about.
Yeah. It's the new platform for information dissemination, for communication, for all this stuff. And probably the most important thing it's done is it has, if you look at history, the previous 100 years was the rise of mass production and centralization and you couldn't do anything without an institution. And suddenly all those economies of scale are far less important because you can do so much more as an individual, whether it's communicating, finding information, traveling, you know, whatever. It's so suddenly the institutions are much more precarious, and the barriers to entry into almost anything are much lower, which means there's more turmoil. And the notion of a 100-year company, there's quite a few of them, but now companies get created and become market leaders and die in 10 or 15 years.
It's pretty amazing to watch. Microsoft, you know, already on the downhill slope. Even Google, you know, one might argue at its peak, but, you know.
No, I'm waiting for the driverless cars. As a New Yorker, I'm really excited.
Will you be the first to buy a autonomous vehicle?
Absolutely.
I'll get in line with you. I don't want to drive anymore. What do we do to protect the internet? How do we go forward as citizens of the internet and keep it open, neutral? These are very important things, and maybe a lot of people don't understand how important it is. Certainly governments don't.
Yeah. Well, the question is, how do we protect it from ourselves?
Yes.
And that's whether it's on the internet or off the internet. That is why we have government, but also why we need to control government, because anything, any center of power is a dangerous attractor.
Yes.
And you know, the great thing about ICANN in the beginning was it was pretty powerless. It couldn't do much, but it kept people from coming in and controlling the internet. Now they're trying to take it over and actually give it more power, such as censorship.
Right.
And at the same time, ICANN itself is trying to create something out of nothing that it can then sell, which is all these new TLDs.
You didn't like this idea of these extra TLDs.
I don't think they add any value. You know, they're kind of like derivatives in the stock market. They're great. You can trade them. Yeah, and they confuse people. They obfuscate what's really going on.
But we've kind of run out of .com names. I mean, there's even a website that says all the good names are taken .com.
But that's not a shortage of names. It's a shortage of space in people's heads.
So what's the solution? I'm not sure. My head is too small. I'm sorry.
I mean, the solution is to deal with it, but it's certainly not to create a lot more names that people can't remember.
Right.
Ultimately, it's to use a search engine and for the search engine to be smart enough to know what you're looking for.
Domain names really aren't even... are less and less relevant.
Precisely.
In fact, when the number one search, and it is close to the number one search on Google.com, is Yahoo.
Or Facebook.
People just type Facebook.
Yeah.
And that's all I need to know.
And they get there.
In fact, Google's smart enough, they just say, oh, yeah, I know what you want. They actually just launch Facebook.
Usually they're right.
Yeah, they're usually right. What else should we watch out for? We got to defend the internet. You do create institutions to protect us and the internet. Those institutions accrete power, and then, as you said, are dangerous attractors of people who want power. How do we solve this problem?
We don't. We live with it. We try to do better, but the one thing you learn from history is that history doesn't end. And
at least we hope not.
Yeah, right. I mean, if it does end, we won't be there to enjoy it.
Right.
One thing we can do is create a backup planet, which is Mars. We can figure out how to deal with this problem that in many ways we are eating and perhaps pleasuring ourselves to death with both sugar, fat, whatever, but also information sugar, which is just useless information that we spend. It's not that I want to turn the world into a park of people walking and reading serious books while they eat raw carrots, but we need to get somehow more disciplined or create, get together and think long term and create more disciplined choices for ourselves, including education for our children, who are, at least in the U.S., getting worse and worse of an education, yet their parents keep thinking they're smarter and smarter. Ugh. You know, we're in the
developed world, are letting our kids down. I look at what we're doing, at least in the U.S., for education.
And we have a really inflated view of how smart we are.
Our medical establishment is, we're like 27th in terms of success.
Yeah. But that's not the medical establishment's problem. It's human behavior's problem. We're going into these hospitals sick and overweight, right, and diabetic and, you know, under deprived of sleep. And, you know, there's a way to be happy without being regimented. And part of it has to do with, again, with education, with everything from dealing with the sugar lobby to the teachers' unions. It's all very dull, but
it's not dull, though. And what I love is that you are an activist, but you're attempting to be an activist at the, you know, at the strongest leverage points. And most of us are outside here trying to work at the top of the gear. You're right in there. You're investing, you're building companies, you're really trying to change things from the most powerful position. I think of Voxiva, which is one of your investments, which is about teaching people to be healthy.
Yeah, well, it's reminding them right at the moment on their cell phones. And it's, We've actually, I mean, the most important thing is, so many things I'm doing this health thing, and I keep reading about all these great programs where, you know, they encourage people to eat right, or they had a website, or, but what we're trying to do is do something where we can actually show the impact,
right,
that people actually ended up healthier, that healthcare costs went down, that the incidence of diabetes went down. And there are a few examples of that, but depressingly few when you consider all the efforts and money and excitement that's gone into that. And that's the thing I'm trying to change. I'm an investor. I want the numbers. I invested stuff, what's coming back, and I'll get more out than I put in, not me personally, but I want to see this thing produce more than what we invest in it.
It doesn't have to be about money in terms of returns. It has to be about making a difference.
Yeah, but if you want it to be sustainable and you want other people to do it, it would actually be nice if it made money long term.
Yeah, a good point. You speak Russian, and we talked about your interest in Central and Eastern Europe. Is that just because of the culture or the feeling you get, or do you feel like that's a particularly fertile area for change?
No, it's completely random. It's like your family,
right?
So my father learned Russian when he was a young man in the UK and thought he was going to Russia, where all the scientists were before the war. And then that didn't work out so well, so he came to the US. But I started, my mother and my stepmother speak German, and I started French in the third grade. So I decided to take Russian in high school. And then I went there in 1989, and for some weird reason, fell in love with this country, which it's unrequited love, and I'm well aware of its flaws, but it's still, you know,
you don't get really Valentine's from Putin? Vladimir's not sending you Valentine's, huh?
Nope.
Well, I think of Lee Felsenstein, who also was very interested. Remember, he was trying to bring computers to Russia?
Yeah, well, he gave me some of my first contacts when I went over there in 1989. And I'm now also on the board of Yandex, which is the leading search engine in Russia, has 60% market share, and is one of the three big search companies in the world, along with Bing and Google.
There may be a lesson, though, in Russia and Central Europe, because it has also become one of the primary sources for malware. And I think that's because you have a lot of very smart, highly trained technical people who can't get jobs, who can't get work. And I think there might be a little lesson there for us.
Yes. It's the Russia's biggest problem is its culture. I mean, it's not getting jobs, but also a corrosive culture.
Yeah.
Frequently.
Corrupt?
Yeah, not everywhere. And the great thing about Yandex and the internet in general is they, by and large, they foster transparency, and they're probably the best part of Russia. But still, there is a culture that, you know, accepts writing viruses as... There's just more of a criminal, corrupt culture there, yeah. But the internet is more of a solution to that than an enabler, even though it also does enable the bad guys to write viruses.
Well, tie this back to our educational failures here in the U.S. Maybe we can even talk about STEM, science, technology, engineering, math education.
Yeah.
Your mother was a mathematician. Your father a scientist.
She's also still around.
I use was, not because they're not here. She's still your mother.
Right.
Is a mathematician. Yeah. And so you have that background. And I think we've agreed that our educational system is failing our children. I worry that doesn't bode well for the long-term future.
It doesn't. And it also, we have this notion that we're American, we should always do better than the other guys. We need to be the world leader. Well, maybe not. And right now we are not. So our education system is this is why I joined the Long Now Foundation. Right. We're so short term, whether it's elections or stock market or education. And the way you build a great society is by realizing you have to build it. It doesn't just happen, and you have to keep rebuilding it and maintaining it and thinking about the long term. Boring as it sounds.
It's not.
Yeah.
We've talked with Stuart about the clock of the long now. I think that's pretty cool.
Right. Yes, it is.
The idea of a clock that strikes every 100 years just to remind you of the time scale we're actually operating on.
Yeah.
Love that idea. So is the first step admitting that we're not number one? That's how the newsroom, the show, the HBO show began. And I thought that was a very propitious beginning to, unfortunately, a show that didn't end up being anything more than a lot of polemic. But the beginning was great, where a college kid says, "Can you tell me, Mr. Anchorman, why America's number one?" And he just rips into her saying, "We're not number one in anything." So when you're talking America's number one, I don't know what you're saying. Yosemite, maybe, but it's not education. It's not medical care. So is the first step admitting that we have a problem?
Yeah, and it's not a tragedy not to be number one. It is a tragedy to be
arrogant,
wasting what you've got and to be deluded and all this sort of stuff. But we need to stop thinking that we need to win so the other guys lose.
Oh, that's good.
But we do need to fix what we've got.
That's a global problem because we are that's a problem of nationalism, if you ask me.
Yeah, I mean, certainly China has huge pollution problems and lots of, but again, it's not us versus them. It's what are we doing here? We're letting our bridges crumble. Our school lunches are horrible.
Gristle.
I'm focusing on that.
Gristle with a little ketchup for vegetables.
Yes, right.
I can't believe we feed people this stuff.
Yeah.
Let alone our children.
Well, it's not just in school. It's food in general.
Yeah. But a Big Mac is so good, Esther. It tastes so good.
Yes. Well, then make it be a treat. When I was growing up, we had oatmeal every day and Cheerios on Sunday.
I don't know even where to start. So many things that you have done in your life, Esther, and so many topics that you've covered and so wide-ranging your interests. It's really a pleasure. It's always a pleasure to talk to you. Is there somewhere you want to tell our audience they should go, they should do, something they should participate in?
They should travel. You know, wherever they are, they should go somewhere else.
I agree.
What you get, so I mentioned Russia. I learned so much about the United States from going to Russia. I came back and I had many more questions and many more insights about the United States. I've been going to Russia now for, 24 years. Wow. And you know, I'm still learning about Russia, but I learned so much about coming back and seeing the U.S. with different eyes, both the good and the bad. And wherever it is that you go, you know, probably not just London. Go somewhere a little more interesting. Experience what it's like when you don't speak the major language. Experience what it's like to be lost in a foreign country. But then also understand how people think about things differently. And you'll realize, oh, there's two ways to look at this problem. There's a different point of view. One of the saddest questions I ever got from anybody was a Bulgarian. We were talking about something or other, and he asked me, so what does the average American think about Bulgaria these days? Yeah. You know.
It's a good question. What did you say?
Yeah. I sort of smiled gently. What can, yeah.
What can you say?
Yeah.
Not a lot. Mm-hmm. We don't really think about Bulgaria much.
No.
In fact, I don't think most of us could even place it on a map.
That's right. And that's, I mean, it's not that you need to know that, but you need to know that you need to get outside your own fishbowl.
I agree. I was so proud of my daughter when she spent her high school junior year, the whole year in France, but even more so because it wasn't in Paris, it was in Rennes.
Yes.
You know, it was out of the big city. And it was with normal, you know, real people, not urban urbanites. And it changed her. She became very interested in the Middle East, in the plight of women in the Middle East. I mean, it just changed her. And I think perspective is so valuable.
Yeah.
And it really does cure that peculiarly, maybe it's not peculiarly American, but it seems American affliction of thinking that, hey, we're number one.
Yeah. And so for me, because... So I go to all these exotic places. I'm actually now spending more time. I was in Madison, Wisconsin 2 weeks ago. I'm exploring the United States as part of this.
That's
hiccup.
Absolutely part of
initiative.
That.
Yeah.
You bet.
And so I don't want to be the rich white lady from New York.
Yep.
I am, but at least I need to get a better sense of what's going on in Madison, Casper, Wyoming, High Point, North Carolina. And it's going to change me again. It's great. I'm embarking on another educational experience, just like the cosmonaut training or working on Wall Street.
Yeah, you were going to go in
Charles
space.
Simonyi.
Simonyi was going into space, and you were, if he couldn't make it on the International Space Station, you would have gone.
Would have gone, but I was very nice. I didn't hope he would get sick.
I would have.
No. I hope that his new wife would call him and say, darling, I'm pregnant. You let that lady go instead. But it didn't happen.
How long is the cosmonaut training? How long does that go on?
It was 6 months.
Wow.
I was living in a closed city in, it was Russia, but it was kind of like the Soviet Union. It was, I wanted not just the space training. I wanted to experience Soviet Russia. So I managed to do that.
Even though it was 2008 and it had long fallen.
Yes, right.
What a great experience. But you kind of knew going in that Charles is going.
Yes. Yeah. No, I didn't do it in the hopes of going. I did it because I wanted the training. And sure, you know, I'd love to get a lottery ticket as well. But I didn't think, oh, you know, I didn't get to go. It was a waste. I thought, wow, this was terrific. I mean, not that it was all wonderful, but it was a wonderful experience. And since I'm still planning to retire on Mars, it's not as if the dream is gone. Yeah.
I tell my kids that. I say, you know, that somebody of your generation is probably going to be the first person to walk on Mars. Make it be you. You could be you. I would love to. If my son said, would you want to go into space? I said, I would go. I guess somebody's taking applications for the first Mars space colony.
Yes. Mars One. I'm an advisor to him.
And, of course, you're not going back. That's a one-way ticket.
Yeah, great place to retire. When you get really old, having one-third gravity is very convenient.
Sure. I didn't think about it that way. So he's getting some applications. At last report, I think it was a million people? 100,000 people.
Hundreds of thousands,
Hundreds of thousands. It's NASA, so it's not like just somebody made this up.
No, no, it's not NASA.
It's not NASA.
No,
it's Bas Lansdorp.
Yeah, he's a Dutch guy.
So he doesn't have help from any governmental agency on this.
He probably will. You know, lots of governments are. Again, they like STEM. It's who knows. I mean, he's buying the spacecraft. He's not building it. So
right.
You know, it's not clear yet who he will buy that service from.
Well, I think my daughter has applied. I'm not sure, but she asked me last night if I left for Mars and never came back.
you could go visit. You could go.
I'm going with her. If she goes, I have to go. Somebody's got to take care of her. Mars-1.com if you want to apply. That is hysterical. So are you going?
Yeah, probably not with Mars 1. As I said, I don't want to go till I'm ready to retire, and that's going to be a while.
Awesome. Well, we hope you never retire. It's so great to talk to you. Thank you, Esther Dyson, for your time. And
thank you very much.
For all your good works. Adventure.com.
Take care.
Read more. Thank you.
And Esther. Hiccup.co.
Now tell me, what is that again, Hiccup?
Hiccup.co, not .com.
.co.
Stands for Health Initiative Coordinating Council. There you go. Great.
Awesome. Lightweight project to develop open source models for communities. Big data, healthy living, and effective health care. The internet's going to solve that one, too.
Nope. People are going to solve it.
People. The internet. It's made of people.
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you, Esther. Take care.
Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye.
Take care.
We do triangulation every Wednesday right about this time, and it's so much fun because you never know who you're going to see. Actually, next week we're going to talk to the founder of Second Life, right? That's going to be very interesting. We've got some great people. Thank you, Karsten Bonney, for lining up so many interesting guests. And I was surprised today. I got the email. Esther's going to be on. I said, oh, wonderful. She's a legend. Triangulation Wednesdays around about 3:30, 4 p.m. Pacific, 6:30 to 7 p.m. Eastern Time, and 2200 to 2230 UTC on twit.tv. But you know what? You don't have to watch live. It's nice if you do. I love it if you do. I get a lot of my good questions from the chat room. But if you can't watch live, you can always watch after the fact. We make on-demand audio and video available always, twit.tv/TRI. Or you can subscribe. That way you get every single episode as they come out. Just go to iTunes or whatever podcatcher you use and say, I want triangulation. Thanks for joining us. Thanks to John Slonina, our technical director. We'll see you next time on TRI.